First case on our calendar, 07-1529, Monica Fletcher versus University Hospitals of Cleveland. Mr. Norkey.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I am Kevin Norkey. I represent one of the appellants in this matter, University Hospitals of Cleveland. I will be offering argument on behalf of the appellants. I would like to reserve 5 minutes time for rebuttal. The issue before this court regards the proper procedure to challenge a violation of Civil Rule 10D2. And specifically, the issue here is whether a motion to dismiss pursuant to Civil Rule 12B6 is an appropriate vehicle to test the sufficiency of a complaint that fails to comply with Civil Rule 10D2. The 8th District Court of Appeals, I submit, misconstrued Civil Rule 10D2 in its opinion. It determined that the sufficiency of the complaint was not affected by the absence of an affidavit of merit. In fact, the clear language of Civil Rule 10D2 establishes that an affidavit of merit does establish the sufficiency of a complaint.
Counsel, is your argument limited to cases that occurred in the window before the most recent modification of the rule?
No, sir. And the reason for that is I believe that very clearly in the amendment for the subsequent rule, the amendment in 2007, identifies it as a clarification of the rule.
Right. The amendment and that rule clearly says that this is not on the merits, a dismissal not on the merits. But this, in this case, you had a dismissal with prejudice. And so I guess my question would be, can you have a 12B6 dismissal without prejudice?
Yes. And the reason is because there are circumstances where a 12B6 motion to dismiss can be otherwise on the merits. And one of the reasons is when this court determines by rule that it is otherwise than on the merits, okay, as it did. There are other readings that can be made of Civil Rule 41A and B that would permit a dismissal otherwise
so
on the merits.
So should this case simply go back, should we simply say Court of Appeals is wrong in saying that the proper approach is a motion to make definite and certain that the proper approach is, in fact, a 12B6 motion to dismiss, but it should be dismissed otherwise than on the merits, so that there is the opportunity to refile if time's not up or you aren't into other problems for refiling the case?
The answer is a yes and a no. The yes is that this court should find that the Court of Appeals construct requiring a 12E motion for more definite statement is not intended by the rule, but it should also, with respect to this particular case, support the trial court's decision that the dismissal was with prejudice because the saving statute had been used, and as just a matter of managing its docket, this case could not have been refiled after the dismissal. So even if it was a dismissal.
So as to this specific case, you would argue the amendment to the rule wasn't in play yet?
I would argue that the amendment is merely a clarification. And there's no mystery with regard to the initial rule, 10D2, that a motion to dismiss is the appropriate tool to test the sufficiency and adequacy of a complaint. It's clearly within the language of Civil Rule 12D2, and it also fits nicely with Civil Rule 10D2.
Well, I think your argument there is persuasive, but the problem is this was dismissed with prejudice.
Correct.
And I'm trying to understand why that should stand.
Because in this particular case, if the trial court dismissed it without prejudice, and I believe there are a number of other cases cited in our briefs where a trial court fashioned the appropriate remedy pursuant to its own discretion, here a dismissal without prejudice would have in effect been practically a dismissal with prejudice. So even if the trial court had dismissed without prejudice or otherwise than on the merit, it would have effectively have been a dismissal with prejudice.
Okay, I understand that, but we're writing not just for this case. You're saying the posture of the case, because it had been dismissed once, refiled, and the running of the clock, the dismissal without prejudice would still have the same effect.
Yes.
So we could essentially, if we agreed with your proposition, send this back, have the court dismiss it without prejudice, and then if there's any attempt to refile it, then that's defeated at the attempt to refile because of the saving statute.
That would be reasonable. That would be reasonable. What this court did in its discretion, though, is look at the history of this case that had been pending for a year and a half. It was dismissed because plaintiffs could not come up with an expert report or an expert affidavit to rebut pending motions for summary judgment. The savings statute was taken advantage of for the full year, 364 days or so, and then it was refiled. Once it was refiled in March of 2006, this case wasn't dismissed again until July. And during that intervening period, there was motion to dismiss was filed, there were reply briefs filed, and there was a case management conference in which the trial judge sat with all the participants, all the counsel. And during that time, it was very clear that this court, the case had been filed, dismissed, and that there was no opportunity for the case to be subsequently refiled at any other time. So I believe that that's the basis for the court's decision to dismiss this matter with prejudice.
If I understand the record correctly, the plaintiff was arguing that they didn't even have to get an affidavit of merit because it was a death case, not a straight malpractice.
Correct, Your Honor.
So they weren't even, were they even attempting to, as far as you know, or were they standing firm on that argument and not even looking for an expert?
Well, the case that was presented to the Court of Appeals was essentially whether or not 10D2 applied to wrongful death claims that are based on a medical claim. And they agreed with the trial court with regard to that proposition. There are other cases that we've cited in our briefs in which pro se litigants have pursued and followed the same theory that we don't believe it applies. It was enacted after we filed our first complaint, and so it doesn't apply. But in those cases, and in this case, it does apply.
Do we need to address that issue, that it does or doesn't apply in this case? Or is that settled law in your view?
That is settled law in my view, and it hasn't been raised on appeal. That is that an affidavit of merit applies to any complaint that contains a medical claim, whether it gives rise to a wrongful death action or a survivorship action. And in fact, there was a survivorship action premised on a medical negligence claim that sort of fell by the wayside in this case as it's come up.
Thank
here.
You.
I would like to reserve the remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Norkey.
Thank you.
Mr. Travers.
Thank you, Your Honor. Please, the court. My name is Tom Travers. I'm here from Youngstown. I represent the estate of Victor Shaw, which essentially is his four minor children. The case was brought in a representative capacity by the fiduciary of the state, who is the mother of the children, but not technically entitled to participate in any damages secured under the wrongful death statute because they were not married. I feel like I must comment. I've only been in front of you once before, and it was in the state office building, and I wasn't impressed. But this is spectacular, and I congratulate you.
We've arrived, Mr. Trex.
I hope it doesn't sound presumptuous of me, but some of the questions that the panel has posed leads me to the first point I was going to attempt to address, and that is whether or not it would be appropriate for you to consider or reconsider whether or not this case was improvidently allowed. The facts of this case are so specific and encompass so many issues that I believe this court would have to address that it just does not seem to be the appropriate vehicle to touch on this one procedural issue. I believe, Your Honor, that the court would have to address the issue of whether or not a wrongful death claim is
a medical
claim.
Your view is that's not settled law.
It is not, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. Norkey suggested that the issue is not before us because it has not been briefed. What is your retort to that position?
My position would be, Your Honor, if you're going to dismiss the claims of my client, essentially you're finding that the wrongful death action is a medical claim, or else it wouldn't require an affidavit.
Did you cross-appeal the denial of that by the court?
I did not, Your Honor.
So then it's not before us if you did not cross-appeal.
Well, there's also an issue that, in my opinion, is significant and distinguishes this case, and that is there's two defendants, University Hospitals and Dr. Anders. Dr. Anders' counsel isn't even here, although he did file a brief, and his situation is quite distinct from that of the hospital. The trial judge dismissed the case against Dr. Anders prior to the time that Dr. Anders had been served. He did not accept the certified mail service. I filed a motion with the court seeking regular mail service. There was an order put on allowing that, but the record does not reflect that that was ever attempted or accomplished, and almost immediately thereafter, the case was dismissed against him. I think that presents a whole different issue as well as to whether or not someone who's not yet a party to the case can have the case dismissed with prejudice as they are arguing against him. Some of the other issues, obviously, as you have suggested, Justice Pfeiffer, the rule has changed since the time that the court made its decision in this case, and I think appropriately changed. I think the panel addressed some of the problems so that situations like this are less likely to occur. But also, within the last year, you, Justice Kupp, have authored an opinion in which this exact same panel unanimously agreed in the case of Manley versus Marsico that essentially says, contrary to what the appellants are trying to accomplish, even if the rule is not complied with by filing an affidavit if it's so required, or if a motion requesting additional time is not filed contemporaneously, that does not mean that the trial judge just looks at those two facts and dismisses the case. This, I find it quite interesting that the whole thrust of the arguments presented by the appellant are, this is so distinct from the type of case requiring a copy of a contract as opposed to requiring the affidavit. And if I may quote your comments, Your Honor, it says we find guidance in Rule 10B which governs statements or attachments to the pleadings. And then you go on to say that Rule 10D2, while not identical, is analogous to the rule that we have here for your presentation today. Appellant wants to have that case completely ignored. I think that the intervening publication of that case also impacts whether or not this is the vehicle to address all of these issues. I believe that the problem with non-compliant complaints as far as affidavits of merits is concerned is no longer the issue that it was at the time that this case was dismissed. The rule was brand new. The only published literature or the case, and admittedly it was not binding precedent, it was from a trial court judge, but in my view quite well reasoned, said you don't need an affidavit to file a wrongful death action, even if it arises out of medical care. And that issue was briefed extensively at the Court of Appeals level, but I follow that logic. I did not file an affidavit of merit, although I had the case reviewed, and I think that inference is obvious from the fact that two of the defendants who were part of the original case were not named in the refiling, even though those two defendants would have kept the venue in Mahoning County where I practice law, but instead I could not find reasonable cause to pursue the claims against them and came to Cleveland to file the lawsuit up here. But I fully expected, Mr. Nortke is correct, we had a case management conference, we set a trial date, we set a pretrial date, we talked about dispositive motion dates, and it was mentioned that this is pending. And I said to the trial judge, it's my belief that an affidavit's not required. The appellant believes that it is required. I expected that he was going to issue a ruling either saying it's not required or it is required, and then permit, under that same logic of Manley versus Marsico, to permit me to file the affidavit of merit. But instead, without notice, without oral hearing, without any notice of a dispositive date, out of the blue, I get this postcard saying this case is dismissed with prejudice against everyone, even though one of the defendants hasn't even filed a responsive pleading or
counsel,
rendered an appearance.
Counsel, you didn't move for extra time to file this affidavit, did you?
That is correct, Your Honor.
So are you saying because the trial court didn't tell you you needed absolutely to file one of this affidavit, you were taken unaware by the dismissal?
I would say that's accurate, Your Honor. And I believe that is one reason why the motion for more definite statement approach is the better approach, because that results in an order which says you didn't file an affidavit of merit, one is required, and you file it by X date or the case will be dismissed. And then I'd file the affidavit of merit. But
is the time ambiguous for when an affidavit of merit should be filed in a case such as this?
If one is required, Your Honor, it's to be filed contemporaneously with the filing of the complaint.
Well, for our purposes, at this point, it is a given that one is required in this particular type of case. Is that correct?
Well, it is.
You didn't cross appeal the issue, and so it's not before us. And, requirement for the heightened pleading requirement with the affidavit, according to the briefs, is to weed out frivolous lawsuits. I mean, that's the policy decision here by the legislature. Is that correct?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And so, if I may, that's why I believe that the procedure adopted by the Court of Appeals is the correct one. You don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater.
But as was questioned, or based on the questions directed to the appellant here, if it is dismissed, there's a chance for refiling when you can comport with the directives of the or the dictates of the statute. So you're not really, unless your timing is off, such as in your case, you do have the opportunity to remedy the imperfect initial filing.
Justice O'Connor, I believe what you say is correct. However, that's not the position of the appellant. They're saying since the case
was in this particular case, but we're talking in the bigger picture here, which is what we have to, be addressing here.
I understand that need, but I also have to factor in the best interests of my client, Your Honor. Judge Landsinger was the author of an opinion called Olnick versus Scholes, and it's on the double dismissal rule, and I think that would address this situation. It doesn't clearly say it addresses this exact situation. I think the logic would be the same, but there are still cases out there that say any two dismissals under the savings statute and you don't get a third opportunity.
But Mr. Travers, isn't that the issue here? I mean, I'm trying to understand if you're saying that we should not look at the narrow issue of the consequence of failure to attach an affidavit. It seems that the Court of Appeals is saying, you talk about looking at it as an extra contract attachment to a complaint, whereas the other side is saying that we're talking about failure to state a claim because the affidavit is not attached. Isn't that an issue that's really ripe for us to decide?
I would answer that by by citing this Manley versus Marsico opinion, Your Honor. I think it's my opinion that it's been decided, and I think that this panel has always come down on the interests of justice rather than just some formality of pleading.
Except in Manley, we were talking about a motion to dismiss for failure to attach the affidavit. I mean, it was couched in that term. It wasn't, it didn't look at, was this the need for a more definite statement, and it didn't address whether it was a failure to state a claim under 12b-6. So I don't think
that's accurate.
I don't think Manley really answers the question before us, does it?
The message of Manley, Your Honor, to me is you, Mr. or Madam Trial Judge, use your discretion, but don't rote by this rule, throw a case out without even finding out why there was no affidavit of merit. I believe that that's the policy that this court will follow if it decides to publish its opinion on that issue. I think it's absolutely the correct position to have. And I tend to believe that the motion for a more definite statement gives a better opportunity for that to occur. If that's responsive to your question, I'm not sure it is.
I guess the thing is we need to let practitioners know when the affidavit is missing, what is the step to take if the other side wants to bring that to the court's attention. Do you file a motion for a more definite statement, or do you file a motion for failure to state a claim? That's a question that I see.
If they were treated the same by the trial court as far as having an opportunity to address all the issues of why there wasn't one filed, and as in Manley, even though there was neither an affidavit nor a request for an extension, to afford, in the interest of justice, if it's appropriate, and the affidavit's there or it just wasn't filed for some reason, if it gives a plaintiff the opportunity to accomplish that, I don't really care which avenue that you would follow. But I think it's essential to be able to have the opportunity to address the trial court. The circumstance in this case was so unusual because I didn't think an affidavit was needed based on the one case. Since then, there's other cases that have rendered differently, and in retrospect, I would have filed an affidavit out of carefulness. And I intended to file an affidavit if the trial judge said, yes, an affidavit is required. But I wasn't afforded that opportunity. The motion for more definite statement, I think, would afford a plaintiff that opportunity.
Counsel, if I'm understanding your take on Manley, if your case were sent back, trial court is told it's dismissed without prejudice, or should be dismissed without prejudice, is it your view in your case that you using what you see as the doctrine of Manley, that you would have one more opportunity to refile with the affidavit?
If I knew that that opportunity would be afforded to me, Your Honor, I'd be arguing less strenuously, I suppose, because that's all I'm looking for. But if, as with the original motion, if you remand it and say the dismissal should be without prejudice, and the same day an order goes on saying without prejudice, before I have an opportunity to file a motion requesting leave to show why the affidavit wasn't filed, then there's at least some case law saying my clients are done forever.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Travers.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Keys Walker, are you going to take rebuttal?
May it please the court, my name is Irene Keys Walker, and today I'm representing the AMICUS, the Ohio Association of Civil Trial Attorneys. I do believe there's both a narrow issue and a potentially broader issue for this court to decide. The narrow issue is exactly as Justice Leidinger said, giving counsel guidance on what to file when no complaint, no affidavit at all is attached to the complaint. And in fact, in our AMICUS brief, we said that the Manley issue, the broader issue, is really not at issue here and need not be addressed. However, the one thing I think that both of us agree on, both sides, is that Manley says that the trial courts have discretion on how to handle failures in the pleadings under Rule 12d2. And I think that that discretion also must apply to trial courts fashioning an appropriate remedy. And in fact, that's what the trial court did in this case. It dismissed with prejudice because that was an appropriate remedy for a case which had been refiled and was being dismissed after the statute of limitations expired.
Ms. Keyes-Walker, you would agree if this had not been dismissed before, it would have been a dismissal without prejudice.
I would, Your Honor.
All right.
And in fact, the case that you have accepted and are holding for a decision on this case, the Holbein versus Genesis Healthcare, is exactly that kind of case. That's a case where it was refiled and dismissed, and the dismissal was with prejudice. And in the third district, I believe it was the estate of Newland versus St. Rita's Hospital, they said, normally we would dismiss without prejudice, or normally we would remand this case for a decision on a Rule 60B motion that was pending, but because the statute of limitations has expired, it would be fruitless. And therefore, we're just going to affirm dismissal with prejudice. And of course, in the Holbein case, the Fifth Circuit said clearly the trial court had the discretion to fashion an appropriate remedy, which in that case was a 12C ruling on the merits. So although this court's rule now clearly states that dismissal for a failure of Rule 10D2 should be without prejudice, I think under Manley, and for a wide variety of cases that this court's going to see in the future, it makes a lot of sense for this court to say, clearly, trial courts have the broad discretion to fashion an appropriate remedy under the civil rules. And if it is clear and undisputed that the statute of limitations has expired, a dismissal with prejudice would be appropriate.
If we were to say that the appropriate remedy for a failure to attach an affidavit is a 12B6 dismissal without prejudice and it goes back down, does the court still retain the ability upon a third refiling to say you're out because of the saving statute, or does that ruling from us on without prejudice bind the court to accept the third filing?
I think that the court would have the opportunity to do that, and that would certainly be an acceptable alternative. My point is only that this court has, in many cases other than Manley, emphasized that the trial court's discretion is broad in handling cases and procedural matters before it, and I think that's a wise rule.
So, and counsel, you're arguing, in essence, judicial economy for this court to sustain the actions below because there's no sense in it would be fruitless to return this to the trial court for a third bite at the apple in a filing.
Exactly, Your Honor.
And the judicial economy, if that would be the motivation for the trial court to fashion under 12D, that would be sufficient.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Counsel, do you disagree with the appellee that at the time it was at the time that this case was dismissed, it was an open question as to whether or not the affidavit was required in a wrongful death case?
I strongly disagree with that statement.
And what case would you rely on for that?
Well, the Common Pleas Court case that is cited for that is the only case that's ever held that. It actually dismissed the survival action in that case for failure to comply with 10D, and it did not dismiss the wrongful death action based on Thompson versus Wing. Thompson versus Wing said it's not res judicata to file a wrongful death action where you have a different plaintiff after a medical malpractice action has been resolved and terminated because you have a different plaintiff, you have a different cause of action. That has nothing to do with when you have one complaint that alleges two kinds of damages, both wrongful death as well as survival, and that single complaint states a medical claim. So I don't think that you can rely on a Mahoning County Common Pleas case that's clearly wrong on its face when there's tons of cases elsewhere that say that medical malpractice and survivor claims are properly brought as one action and they are medical claims, although perhaps not in the context of whether 10D applies, and expect that to be reliance, especially when faced with a motion to dismiss. But I also agree that that issue is not before this court.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Keyes-Walker. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.